Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the CapEx podcast Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. Not many organisations can claim to have had Adam Smith, Edmund Burke and Karl Marx as members. Then again, not many organisations are anything like the Royal Society for the Encouragement of Arts, Manufactures and Commerce, better known today as the RSA. For over 260 years, its mission has been nothing short of improving an entire nation, funding inventions, encouraging trade, planting millions of trees, putting on the Great Exhibition, and creating Britain's first exam board. And in that time, it's been a hotbed of utilitarianism, a home to conservatives, radicals, and even the founding father of communism. Who better to discuss this fascinating, intensely colourful history than Anton Howes, the RSA's house historian, whose History of the Society, Arts and Minds, was released in May. I began by asking Anton the obvious question: what is the RSA actually for?
Basically, the RSA is Britain's semi-official, voluntary, subscription-funded national improvement agency in anything and everything, and has been for the past 260-odd years. And what that means is that it was doing all sorts of different initiatives, whatever it thought filled the gaps in what was being done in Britain and increasingly the world at the time. So that's anything from, in its early days, prizes for inventions that weren't patented, so the sorts of inventions that may not be profitable off the bat, or the sorts of inventions that they felt would benefit the public good. In the 19th century, that meant things like exhibitions, the Great Exhibition of 1851, the famous Crystal Palace, that was actually their initiative originally, and then kind of taken forward by a royal commission just to make things a little bit more official, but still the same people involved in it. The first public examinations in this country, in a kind of general sense, were a utilitarian project, so the growth of the early education state, or the state's involvement in education, that's another of their initiatives. Patent reform, copyright reform, buying an entire village in the 1920s.
This is West Wickham.
That's right, yeah, West Wickham, which, you know, if you go there, you'll see a little plaque saying purchased and restored by the RSA and then handed over to the National Trust to preserve ancient and medieval cottages. And then even in the 1960s, people like Prince Philip, who was the president at the time, being involved in the origins of what we now call environmentalism.
It's a remarkable organisation because it kind of defies, like you say, it kind of seems to defy categorisation. I mean, there's one bit where you talk about a typical year of the Society's lectures might actually include lectures entitled Recent Improvements in Decorators' Materials, The Economic Importance of a Study of Insect Life, War Balloons, Old Age Pensions and the Role of France in West Africa. Is there a kind of coherent thread to that? Is it just the desire for improving things?
Yeah, I think that's the only coherent thread you can pull when you start looking at those sorts of different things. I mean, those are some of the 19th century lectures. Today you might have a bunch on behavioural economics or, you know, like I think the typical thing, and you might have, you know, a lot of big thinkers, Steven Pinker and so on, coming and giving their talks and just trying to provoke the society's members and the public at large. Yeah, I think improvements are general, trying to, as I said, filling in the gaps. That seems to be a phrase I kept on coming across throughout from people who were involved, especially in the later 20th century. And earlier you kind of have equivalent things being said. So trying to find whatever's not being done. And that's it defies categorization, which actually, unfortunately, also means that you struggle with to shift a book that where it's about defining the thing itself. You can't just say, you know, it's not like I've written a book about Ben Franklin and people are like, well, I know about that, so I'm going to find out more. It's trying to kind of educate people about this, I think, fascinating aspect of British history, the kind of hidden seam of social reform for this extended period of time and with all of these same people involved in it.
Yeah, I think the way you describe it at one point is as a vehicle, and that's certainly what appeals, with different kind of prominent figures hopping on and off, perhaps taking control. I mean, I wonder though, having, it seems to me, it's obviously well known now, but in the middle of the 19th century, it seems to be completely integral to the public life of the, not just Britain, but the empire as well.
In the 18th century, it would have been the club for a lot of people. Not that it's a club, but the kind of society where you know, pretty much every prime minister of the late 18th century and early 19th century was in some way involved, maybe just tangentially in a way that they just kind of paid the subscription fee, became a member. But it was one of the high status things that people would subscribe to, partly because it was the only game in town in terms of the kinds of societies that existed. 19th century, certainly, though, with the Great Exhibition, you know, that gets a lot of people's attentions, and suddenly they think they see it as a vehicle for their own reforms. Examinations were one of the things that came off the back of that, trying to support the mechanics institutions, so sort of bottom-up, self-educating workers, often, you know, going to creating their own night schools in a way. Mm-hmm. Birkbeck University being a famous successor to the London Mechanics Institution still has its evening classes in that kind of original vein, as well as things like limited liability becoming more generalized in the 1850s, trying to extend education to girls for secondary education. So the Girls Public Day School Trust used the RSA as a platform to try and get going. You could go on and on. We could spend the whole thing me just listing initiatives.
It is one of those books where you're constantly reading it going, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that Brunel had designed the original Great Exhibition.
Mm.
It's a giant steel dome.
Yeah.
And then, well, I think one of the things that comes across in it, actually, particularly with a character called Henry Cole, is how much little kind of twists of fate have changed. So it's someone getting his design in front of the right person for the Crystal Palace meant that sort of usurped Brunel. I mean, as a historian, how given are you to seeing these things in terms of, oh, it was destined to be like that because certain structures were in place, or are there just little moments, and particularly individuals without whom this story would have been completely different?
Yeah, I think, you know, Henry Cole's a really interesting one. I like to say that he's, you know, great man theory often gets knocked, or great person theory, I guess, often gets knocked, and with good reason. But I think there are a few individuals where maybe it does apply, and Henry Cole's probably one of them, right? He's just a powerhouse. He goes from project to project to project to project, successfully in many cases. Things mm-hmm. like, you know, he's involved with the introduction of the penny postage, which to us is like such an obvious thing.
So just for our listeners, I mean, what sort of years are we talking? He ran the society in the mid-19th century.
Right, so he comes to dominate the society in the late 1840s, early 1850s, and pretty much for the rest of his life, right up until the 1880s. He's the key figure that, even though he's not technically in charge, he's not the president, he's not the secretary, he's, I think, just a vice president for most of that period. He's the chairman only briefly for about a year or two. You know, the society often gets called King Cole's Parliament because whatever idea he had, he gets to air there and try to use it as a platform. And I think one of the reasons he could be so successful in pushing reforms, and I'm talking the first major overhaul of the patent system in 1852. There hadn't been any really legislation since the 1620s that kind of really defined the system. Copyright reform, what else? Oh, the introduction of military drill exercises in schools.
Postage, you said that's
penny postage is actually before the society, but it's just another example of just him kind of applying his principles and getting involved with things. At one point, he's asked to lead the Anti-Corn Law League in London by Richard Cobden, though he turns that down. So he's clearly a campaigner with great effect, and he does get things done. So he also ends at the same time, I think one of the reasons he's so successful is that he wears multiple hats. So he's vice president of the Society of Arts, he wheedles his way into various other societies, gets if he needs to use them for various things, but he's also a civil servant. And so after the Great Exhibition, given he manages to make this huge success, he then gets his own department, the Department for Science and Art, eventually, which then means he gets to control South Kensington, basically. In fact, he invents South Kensington. He even comes up with the name South Kensington, because before that area was usually called Brompton. Kensington Palace nearby, yeah. And he thinks, you know, this is a much posher sounding neighbourhood. And so he creates the South Kensington Museum, which nowadays the usual successor that's named, although it kind of is more complicated than that, but the usual successor is the V&A, as well as agglomerating all of these different museums to that area. So the whole museum mile is really his project. With Prince Albert's support, and Albert, I think, gets a lot of the credit nowadays in, you know, whatever TV shows about the Victorians you might watch. But I think Henry Cole is the real driver here, to the extent that actually there's at one point it seems like Albert is trying to hide some of his projects from Cole in case he gets his hands too involved.
One thing I liked about it is, and we'll come on to the kind of links with the ideological side of the society, because it almost looks like a mirror to the trends that were going on in that time, but Cole was this sort of arch-utilitarian, and one of the things he didn't mind just lying repeatedly, including to Prince Albert, as you said.
Yeah, the ends justified the means. So if you think of the basic utilitarian principles, ends justify the means, Cole has that all over. Although, you know, he can appear self-interested, but at times I always think he's breaking rules in the public interest, or at least what he sees to be the public interest. And then also the principle of the greatest good for the greatest number. So this is the period where the society really tries to start rolling out projects that affect everybody. Mass education, the Great Exhibition, which is something that, in theory, the entire public can benefit from, rather than, as they were doing before, prizes for individual inventors, even though it has that knock-on effect. Big mass reforms, changes to the law, I think that also comes under that, right? I think a lot of the way that, I guess, policy people today act in terms of, you know, calling for something to happen has a kind of Victorian origin story, at least it's kind of a part of that story to it in terms of the default thing that campaigners do. So he's friends with John Stuart Mill, so Bentham's disciple.
Yeah.
But then Cole has a bit of a twist to it. So he's not really a philosopher himself. He's a doer. I like to say that his mantra is kind of utilitarianism applied. I could go on and on about Cole.
Yeah. I think there's a bit where you talk about how he felt uncomfortable with actual philosophers.
He seems to be out of his depth a lot of the time when it comes to the utilitarian circles.
But that's the RSA all over, isn't it? They're the ones who actually do stuff rather than just cogitate. And you set out in the very beginning, there's this difference between the French kind of Cartesian approach and the savant versus the fabricant. And the RSA was always steeped in the latter rather than... So it's a kind of... speaking of savant versus fabricant, the competition with France seemed to be one of the things as well which spurred the society onto kind of ever greater things.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason for that is that talking about national competition gets things done a lot of the time, right? It's that you sometimes need to kind of confect an enemy of some sort to get certain reforms through. Actually, Cole's a good example of this. So he gets the Great Exhibition off the ground because it looks like the French are going to do something similar first. And in fact, they're copying the national exhibitions that had been going on in France since the 1790s, one of Napoleon's initiatives, to promote catch-up with Industrial Revolution Britain. But then they kind of use the fact that France seems to be catching up via these exhibitions to get an exhibition of their own. They try to be the first to have an international exhibition. They also then, when the exhibition does happen, say, look, actually the French are still catching up and we've just been able to compare like with like, you know, the French machines next to the British machines in the same room. And it seems like we therefore need to get the reforms that I happen to have been interested in for a few decades or so past as well. So mass education, reform and so on.
And that brings me on slightly tangentially to the next point, which is that you say that at the time, let's say, would you say it was the heyday in the mid-19th century of the society, the state was much, much smaller than we now know it. And you say the main thing it did was fight wars and service the debt from previous wars. I mean, to what extent do you think that the efforts of the likes of Henry Cole and his colleagues helped move the state into other areas?
I think very much so. And this is one of the interesting things, is that when we look at 19th century history, I think a lot of us just kind of assume that the state moving in that direction was quite inevitable, that we would just get more and more social programs, that you would have this kind of shift of the state beyond just warfare. And actually, one of the things I was quite surprised in the research for this book was actually just how tiny the group of campaigners was that achieved that. Cole is one of them, he's not the only one, but really there aren't that many utilitarians actually in Britain at the time, but their effect on policy is outstanding. I mean, it just is astonishing, just this tiny group of MPs, radicals, people who were involved with Bentham in the early days and then with Mill in the mid-19th century. I can't even imagine that they could command anything close to a majority in the House of Commons. And yet somehow at crucial periods, they're leveraging certain institutions or getting certain committees formed to, you know, first of all, get things like schools of design in the 1830s. Again, competition with France is one of the key things there. Then in the 1850s, off the back of the Great Exhibition, Cole gets to reform the schools of design via his new department. They start introducing examinations. I mean, examinations are a really clever way, really ingenious way of introducing the state education system, because one of the constraints that people had on the time, if they wanted to create something like that, was that schools were overwhelmingly run by religious groups. So if the state gets involved, do you teach... what religion do you teach in school? If you have Anglican schools, then the dissenters, the nonconformists, are going to put their hands up and say, don't do that. If you teach dissent, you obviously can't teach any of the dissenting creeds in school because Anglicanism is the established religion. If you say, don't teach any religion in school at all, both sides say, oh my God, don't do that either. And so examinations were a clever way of getting around that, because instead of getting involved in the schools themselves, they could just get involved in what the teachers taught in those schools. And leave the actual management of the schools to whatever groups were already doing it. So they come up with things like teaching to the test. In fact, they create the test so that the teaching to the test can take place for things like the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, for science and design, which are Cole's, or Cole's thing is really design, but science and design, which is department overseas. And then paying teachers, seemingly one of his ideas as well, based on the results that they get in those exams. And so because teachers were quite poorly paid at the time, I guess it was ever thus, right? But teachers were very, very famously at the time poorly paid. And so this was a great way for them to get a bonus, was to teach a bit of science, get their students to pass these exams.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, and it's one of the other things that you touched on, is the way that the RSA, along with other things that were happening, such as the repeal of the Corn Laws, which is completely connected to, like you said, to Henry Cole and so on, were kind of dragging Britain from an aristocratic type of system into something much more meritocratic. And you could say it was a kind of engine of social progress as well as one of innovation in a kind of industrial sense.
Yeah, I think the kind of improvement they're aiming for is not just specific technological improvements. You know, for Cole, it's not just greatest good for the greatest number, its greatest beauty for the greatest number. He gets obsessed with the idea of better aesthetics for the British people. The VNA's secret mission, you know, in the early years when he's doing it, is to try and expose people to good examples of good taste.
Yeah,
and in one case, even bad taste.
Teapots and things like this as well.
Yeah, teapots. And so, in fact, that's how he gets an audience with Prince Albert, is by winning a competition on which he was one of the judges, so that he can meet him for the prize giving. But yeah, teapots, carpets, wallpapers, what have you, and just designing everyday objects within the home, as well as getting people to be able to go to museums and expose them to better designs in that way. I mean, that's why he sees exhibitions as a really interesting project.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, what can you draw on from the way that the RSA tried to stimulate innovation that perhaps could be, is kind of evergreen lessons about what works and what doesn't work? So premiums is one of the things that that comes across, that it often does work very well.
Yeah, so there's a few from the different... I mean, what's interesting is, I think today you kind of need institutions like the RSA, what they did in the past, in addition to what currently goes on. So it's almost like they moved on from each of these initiatives, but actually some of those initiatives could well be resurrected, I think, to great effect. Prizes, premiums for non-patented inventions is one of them. Now, the non-patented bit is quite interesting. A lot of people have often assumed that they did that because they were anti-monopoly, they were anti-patent, it was this kind of thing against the public good. Now, maybe there's a bit of that in the early days, but actually it also has this other effect of meaning that when you give prizes, you're giving it for inventions that would not already have been done, right? Because patents were expensive, you only patent if it's going to be a profitable thing, at least at the time. Nowadays, I guess it's much more common, it's much cheaper, partly thanks to society's own lobbying in the 1840s and 50s. But having these prizes, this prize system, I think was extremely effective because it complemented the existing innovation-promoting systems like the patent system. It meant that the kinds of inventors that got rewards were the kinds of people who were doing stuff, maybe if they patented in another field, but they would also invent something that was a consumer safety improvement, you know, off the top of my head, things like safer carriages, things that would... improvements to ceramics to prevent leakage of lead that might be in the clay or in used in the pottery process. You know, they have all these fears about ways that industry has been impacting health, as well as worker safety improvements. Famously, the Scandoscope for cleaning chimneys, which was to basically make the kids unemployed because they were worried that, you know, kids as young as four are getting these horrific cancers because they're being sent up chimneys to clean them. Turns out you can actually come up with a pretty easy way of a machine for cleaning it, you know, as an adult without actually anyone having to go up inside the chimney. And then also, having those sorts of prizes, having an alternative to the patent system, meant that you involve other kinds of people in innovation. So people who are too rich in some ways to get involved with, you know, muddying their hands with vulgar occupations, the aristocrats, for them they'd get the honorary medals, which they might get from some duke or some prince, depending on who's, you know, at the prize giving, as well as people who are too poor to patent, for which it's just unaffordable, but might still want to get some kind of reward, as well as excluded groups. So lots of women winning these prizes, occasionally ethnic minorities, which, you know, in Britain in the 18th century, it's extremely rare for people to be involved in that kind of way.
Yeah, that's one of the things that comes across, is how far ahead of its time it is. So one of the, they allowed women in sort of 200 years before they got the vote. Indians, who at the time were obviously completely marginalised, I think you say in the 30s, an Indian managed to become, I forget the title.
A chairman of the RSA in the 30s, yeah. So, and first, I think, Indian member, at least in the 1840s.
Yeah. I mean, was it seen by the rest of society as this slightly kind of bohemian, radical organisation?
I don't think so. I've not noticed anything like that. I think it always had a kind of air of officialdom to it.
Because
even
of the royal connection
before
as
it
well.
Was royal, though. Yeah. So the royal only gets added in 1908. Only royally chartered in 1847. So from 1754 to 1847, it's just an unincorporated association, basically. I mean, it has no secure, proper legal standing. It just happens to be so influential, given, as I said, you had 18th century prime ministers and so on involved.
Yeah.
To the extent that in the 1810s, when there's a crackdown on societies because of fears of a kind of new revolution following the French one, because the Earl of Liverpool happens to be a vice president, they kind of just ignore the law there that's about these societies getting special license to continue operating, because they just assume, even though they actually technically to the letter of the law, should have been getting some kind of license to sit and hold these meetings. They just kind of get his personal assurance they don't need to. So I think it's always been at this kind of stage. At the same time, they were attracting radicals. And I think because of its potential for getting things done, and I guess getting the ear of those sorts of people who are involved, you do get a lot of people over the centuries who kind of have an agenda, and so they want to use its network in that way.
Just moving on a bit from, I mean, we've talked a lot about the 19th century. How does the society evolve in the after, say, the First and Second World Wars?
Yeah, it's an interesting period. So what happens is, in some ways, you get a real lack of activity, although you do get these kind of bright spots, like we mentioned the purchase of West Wickham, mm-hmm. this campaign for the preservation of ancient cottages. You know, it has Ramsay MacDonald, Stanley Baldwin, David Lloyd George, the Queen, all of them involved in this campaign, as well as the environmentalist stuff in the 1960s. And then later on, the 1990s as well, you've got a kind of resurgence. But I think what happens is that a few things, really. Maybe this is a kind of warning to non-profits of all kinds, is that if you get very secure sources of income, which it does in the 1880s when it starts charging for examinations in order to pay the cost of continuing them, what happens is that by the 1980s, so about 100 years later, the RSA is actually an examinations board with this weird society thing, you know, undefinable organization attached to it. So what happens is that it kind of has this other source of income, even though there's actually very little mixing of the incomes there. But at the same time, it gets that royal connection, or at least makes it more explicit in 1908. Members start referring to themselves as fellows, which creates the perception that it's actually some kind of exclusive club rather than just a subscription-funded, you know, improvement agency or fund for people to use for these public-spirited ends. And so people either think it's some kind of weird learned society or it's some kind of club. And so membership just goes up and up and up, regardless of what it's doing. And at the same time, it has that extra financial support from the exams. And so it doesn't actually feel the need to do things. There's very much less of an incentive to do things. Whereas if you look at the run-up to the Great Exhibition, the society almost dies and has to completely reinvent itself because people just aren't being involved. So, you know, post-Great Exhibition, you see this steady decline again after this huge spike in membership. And then from the 1900s, roughly, with that royal connection, it just goes up and up. And has continued to this day. Right now, there's over 30,000 people. But what I think has happened is that in the recent past, there have been a few really, I think, crucial decisions that have put the society back on the right track. First of those being hiving off the exam board. So nowadays, you know, a lot of parents and kids will be familiar with OCR, which stands Oxford Cambridge RSA, right? It's actually a merger of the existing, of the original public examinations boards, all set up by this very small group of utilitarians at around the same time in the 1850s. Somehow these that all inspired one another around the same time then ended up re-merging in the 1990s after the RSA got rid of its, kind of, you know, separated it out formally. But when it did so, it lost three-quarters of its staff, three-quarters of its revenue, its entire operating surplus. And so suddenly it has to force itself to actually find new things to do. Again, find gaps to fill, which is challenging, right? That's every organization except the RSA has a thing it does, and it just does those things, and it either continues doing those things successfully or it doesn't. With the RSA, it does something, it then hands that over to someone else, and then it has to find something completely new to do once it's clear that the niche is being filled. And so that means that it's become a mother of societies. You've got all these spin-offs that continue today, like the Royal Academy, like the Blue Plaque Scheme, like the Fourth Plinth on Trafalgar Square, continue on and on, but some of the ones... Yeah. Those.
It just seems like an endless list of things that it's either attached to or originated.
Yeah.
Well, I had no idea the Blue Plaque was RSA, for example. I thought it was, I don't know, Historic England or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is now run by Historic England, but before that, London County Council, it was a London thing, and before that, the RSA for a few decades, actually. And again, often what's interesting is you have these secret missions behind them that people don't appreciate today. So the Blue Plaques were, before the introduction of planning law, all about preventing buildings from being torn down, because for the Victorians, newer was better. You know, now it's like older is better, because there are certain construction skills, I suppose, that, you know, really made these buildings last. But for the Victorians, they were tearing stuff down, you know, regardless.
So, I mean, fast forward to 2020. I mean, what is... I look at the RSA's work now. I mean, one of our columnists works at is the head of future work at the RSA. I mean, that seems to me to be one of their main kind of streams, is working out how what a kind of good economy looks like.
Yeah, I think there's a few things that have been bubbling around since the mid-20th century. Things like, what does work look like for people with such massive acceleration in technology? So a lot of people at the RSA are interested in things like universal basic incomes, trying to get a trial set up for those sorts of policies. They're also interested in things like deliberative democracy, which is actually kind of interesting because it actually harks right back to the society's roots, because for the first 100 years, actually, the society itself was a deliberative democracy. Mm-hmm. It was one person, one vote, male, female, whatever. And, you know, if you had a proposal, you'd just stand up in the meetings every Wednesday and just kind of try and get this new prize or this new initiative funded through a majority vote. So it's interesting that it's kind of gone back to that. But yeah, deliberative democracy, the future of work, often an interest in education as well. So right now the RSA has a sort of partnership, having set up various academy schools when academies became a policy in the Blair years. So there is an RSA chain of academy schools, for example, which again also originates with something else a bit older from the 1970s and 80s, which was this idea of completely reimagining education as being about competencies and not, you know, the actual specific knowledge itself, but about teaching capability, education for capability, they called it. Now, unfortunately, that didn't quite work out in the early first few years, partly, I think, just because parents pressured the schools into actually taking the exams more seriously. So some of these initiatives, they have to change or adapt based on whether or how successful they are as well.
Well, I mean, Anton, it's been a whirlwind tour through about 150 odd years of... How old is it, actually?
266 now.
266, yeah, maths. Clearly, I need to go to the RSA and get some arithmetic lessons. So, thank you very much. And the book, Arts and Minds, is out now. Is it available in all good bookshops?
Yes.
It is.
Good
Excellent.
Bookshops. Yeah.
Good bookshops, or online. So, thank you very much, Anton.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.